This interview is with John H. Van Vleck in his Cambridge, Massachusetts home on September 12, 1978. Mr. Van Vleck, I understand that though you weren't born in Madison, you were born in Connecticut, is that
right?
That's
correct. I was born in Middletown, Connecticut.
But that you were fairly young, around seven or so, when your family moved to Wisconsin.
That is correct. I was 7 years old. Father got the Wisconsin offer when he was on a sabbatical in Europe in 1905 to 6, and I remember vaguely the family trying to decide whether to accept the Wisconsin offer or for him to stay at Wesleyan in Middletown, where he was a professor.
Do you recall what decided him to go to Madison instead of Wesleyan?
No, I wouldn't have known enough.
You would have been pretty small, I think. So you...
Of course, it was a larger and more distinguished university with a lot of graduate work and so on. I mean, in that sense, distinguished. Wesleyan was a distinguished undergraduate college.
But your grandfather had been at Wesleyan, had
he? Yes, he had been acting president on two occasions, so he had many ties to Wesleyan. I'm proud of the fact that my grandfather and my father and I all have honorary degrees from Wesleyan.
That's very nice. You must have presumably started school then. Or had you gone to school before you went to Madison?
If I like to say, sound highbrow, I say I began my education in Paris and continued it in Göttingen because I was in some sort of a kindergarten in both Paris and in Göttingen. In fact, when I got an honorary degree from the Sorbonne over 50 years later, they referred to me as an ancien élève de l'école Alsacienne, an ancient pupil of the Alsacian primary school there.
So,
which is right in Paris, not in Alsace.
Now, this was conducted in French, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. And you knew French at that age, or you learned it quickly?
I tried to.
You tried to. So then you went to Madison, and from knowing about your father, I gather you grew up there.
Yes, I grew up there. When we first moved to Madison, father was a very good friend, Professor Skinner, then already on the staff, because they'd both been instructors at Wisconsin in the 1890s, and Professor Skinner and Mrs. Skinner very kindly offered the Van Vleck family the hospitality of their house for a brief period, until they finally found up a house for rent, where they were very scarce in Madison. Mrs. Pewter said she was going to rent her house to the Van Vlecks, and people said, "Why, we haven't heard anything about it. Has he rented it yet?" And she said, "No, but it's the only house for rent in Madison." Well, it shows a little of the scarcity of rental properties in a mushrooming town. It was a house on Wisconsin Avenue. And when we bought, our father bought the house at 519 North Pinckney Street a year later, we only had a block and a half to move.
That sounds pretty easy as moving
yes.
goes.
Yeah, I remember my parents telling me I could cart my toys from my little train from one place to another.
Oh, you had a train then?
Sure.
I know.
I had a little wind-up one a little later. That's before I had an electric train.
So you started your interest in trains pretty young.
Yes. I had a request from the librarian of the Children's Library at the University of Minnesota. Their current collection is housed in the part of the library which used to be called the Arthur Upson Room, which is a browsing room. But since the Minnesota Library has moved across the river, or at least part of it, that room has become a children's collection. I've given them a number of my childhood books because it's probably the best collection of child's books in the country, or children's books in the country. And I had a letter from them asking me what piece of literature influenced me the most as a child. And I replied, it was when my grandfather gave me an Italian timetable to read when I was 6 years old with diphtheria in Bologna. And that started me interested in railroad timetables and started me on my railroad hobby.
Well, I was going to ask you how you got started, because I learned from Mark Ingram that you very early, like at about six, I think he said, could quote all the schedules.
Well, see, our travel, family were traveling quite a bit when they were on their sabbatical, and I think that's what triggered it off. I had enough of an analytical mind that the railroad timetables interested me.
And I understand went on. You carried this on later.
Yeah.
What school did you go to in Madison?
Washington High. Washington Grammar School. I guess it's called Washington School. Corner of Broom and, dear, my memory's bad. Is it Gorham or Johnson Street?
Well, probably it's Johnson.
I'm not sure.
By that time, by the time it gets across State Street, I think it becomes Johnson.
No, it's still Gorham over there.
It's still Gorham over there? Well, it branches somewhere. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe it's there anymore. You didn't, then for high school, where'd you go?
Madison High.
Madison High.
Now so-called Central.
Well, it was. It no longer exists. They've discontinued.
It's sort of a vocational school now, isn't it?
Well, the vocational school has taken over Central, and Central was closed as a high school about 12 years ago, something like that.
And we felt very superior to the what later became Wisconsin High.
Oh, you did?
And then was at one time something was called the Wisconsin Academy. And by and large, in that very early age, well, that was where all the problem children were sent. At least that's what we thought at Madison High, and we felt, or at Washington School, perhaps I should say, and we felt very superior to the predecessor of the Wisconsin High. We used to refer to that as a fool's retreat or the waste paper basket. That was our name.
That's
for the
name
predecessor of the Wisconsin High, which of course became later a very distinguished high school.
Yes, I've heard of it. But I am interested in your feeling of competitiveness with this other school.
Well, it's not confined to me. I was universal among all the kids.
Oh, yes. So, and what kind of program did you I'm just interested in what was taught in high school then. Were you required to take things, or did you have certain choices?
A certain amount of choice. I took 4 years of Latin, and not a moderate amount of mathematics, but I didn't study calculus until my junior year in college. Nowadays, people even have them in their junior year in high school.
Yes, I've heard. This does represent something of a change. Do you think this is helpful, or what do you think about studying it that much younger?
Oh, I suppose it helps, but sometimes it gets people started prematurely in a subject for which they have no particular ability. On the other hand, sciences are much more complicated than they used to be. I suppose the earlier you can get started, the better. Father always felt that he was late in shifting to mathematics because he studied physics for a year with Roland at Hopkins. In those days, it was just experimental physics. I don't think my father had the temperament or the manual skill of a good experimental physicist, and it was only later that he, after he'd been a instructor for a year or so at Westland, that he realized that it was mathematics and not physics that was his real field of competence. It's strange that nobody ever suggested to his studying with Gibbs at Yale, because Father rather liked applied mathematics. But Gibbs, as you know, was a person who was almost a mystic figure. He had practically no students, PhD students, and his great achievements were not properly appreciated at the time in the United States, and only by a very limited group in Europe.
I'm a little curious. I understand that as many people in various fields, particularly scientific fields, did studied in Europe after their degrees here, and your father went to Göttingen.
Well, I think most people went to Europe for their PhDs rather than going as postdocs. I don't think the word postdoc had a meaning, scarcely, even 1920 or so, or just begun to have a meaning anyway. Father took his PhD in Europe. I think Max Mason did. I can't remember where Mendenhall did.
Well, I knew that, and at least from what I've read, you did not. I mean, I knew you got your PhD at Harvard.
Yes.
Had you ever, or did you consider doing any work in Europe?
Well, after I got my PhD, I thought of some time of getting a Guggenheim Fellowship and traveling and spending a time in Europe, but that wasn't until 6 or 7 years after I got my PhD.
Mm-hmm. Why did you, well, I suppose it's pretty obvious, but why did you choose Harvard after, for your graduate work?
Well, that is very simple. And it's the following. Father was invited to be visiting lecturer at Harvard for the spring semester of the year 1920. I had taken two summer schools at the University of Minnesota, and one at Chicago. And Mother had the idea that maybe if I could eke out a few more credits, it'd be nice if I came along with a family when I went to Cambridge in February 1920. I needed additional credits of, I suppose maybe 2 or 3 credits, and family didn't encourage me taking on a fifth course in Wisconsin. So I was able to persuade the French department to let me take a reading course in Molière. And those gave me the additional credits, enabled me to graduate in 1920 in February. I'm still listed as a class of 1920 rather than 19. And that's how I got to Harvard. I liked the work in physics that I attended, and the courses that I attended. Also took a course in railway operation in the Harvard Business School, a rather unusual thing, but it convinced me that that was not the field in which I was likely to be successful. I lacked the physique, and
but you had really
a mixer and various other qualities that one needed to be successful as a railroad man, and it's a long ways of getting up in that too. So I just decided to keep on in physics.
Had you thought of was it research that interested you, or teaching, or a combination of both?
Don't think I did much thinking about it. I just lived on a purely opportunistic basis, and when I started work courses with Professor Kemble in the fall of 1920. It was his course in quantum theory that particularly fascinated me, and that's how I got into the field of quantum theory and quantum mechanics. And I think I always felt that my career would presumably be in teaching, mainly because it didn't have many research positions in industry at that time. I don't think I ever thought about that possibility.
Well, that, of course, that whole area has developed so fast after, I guess, World War II, particularly.
I'd say my whole career has, in a certain sense, have been an opportunistic one. I'm not a person that had physics written in front of me and electric lights, so to speak, when I was in high school. Not like President Conant, who always knew he wanted to be a chemist. I never had any predilection as to a particular field while I was in college. I just found out which field I seemed to be the best qualified for, and that was it.
Well, I mentioned it earlier, but I might repeat the question. My wondering is whether the atmosphere in your home was such that you took it for granted that you would go on after graduation from college to further study.
I always said as a child I was not going to be a college professor, but when I got older and got more sense, I realized that that was the field for which I was best qualified.
Now, what took you to Minnesota?
A very good offer. That's easy. That Professor Swan, who was one of the top-ranking figures of his academic generation in physics, partly of the mathematical variety, left Minnesota and went to Chicago. There was a vacancy in Minnesota, and Minnesota had the idea of appointing two young men instead of an older man of established reputation. The choice at that time, I should say, among the older men was not a great one because there were so few people in physics at that time. So Bright and I were invited to go to Minnesota as assistant professors with no undergraduate teaching. And that was a remarkable opportunity in those days. You hear and read all the time how in the United States all our promising people were kept down by big burdens of undergraduate teaching. And that was certainly not always so. It was not true for Bright and me at the university. But this was a rather exceptional opening. And I feel I owe a great deal to the University of Minnesota. Prior to then, I'd been an instructor for a year at Harvard. A lot of elementary teaching, which I think I was, not a flop, but not a particularly successful at, but it took a great deal of time grading all these lab reports and so on. So I didn't have much time for research that year. Minnesota took time working up these graduate lectures, but that's a little different matter. It really helped me develop an increasing background.
How did you happen to meet Richard Hartson, because
very
it's
simple.
A completely
he
different
came to
field.
I came to University of Minnesota, I believe, in the fall of 1924, 1 year after I'd come there. I came there in 23. I presume we met at the campus club or at some reception somewhere. I'm afraid I cannot pinpoint the very first place at which I met Dick. We were very close and good friends during the time that We're at Minnesota, and later on, I don't know whether we overlapped at Wisconsin or not. Do you remember what year he came to Wisconsin?
I think he didn't, because he was, I think he stayed in Minnesota quite a bit longer, and I believe you'd already gone to Harvard.
That's my impression.
I think it was in the 40s sometime.
Oh, that's
just bad. Before World War II.
Oh, well, I left Wisconsin in 34.
Yeah, so I think it was some years before he did. Well, then what took you from Minnesota to Wisconsin?
That was a very, very difficult decision. A decision that either way I played it, I would never feel completely happy about, because Minnesota had done so much in offering this position of a purely graduate nature. But Wisconsin was my alma mater. My parents lived there, and Wisconsin did have the additional bait of having a distinguished foreign physicist as a visitor for a semester each year. That was an arrangement which was, let's say, more or less dangled as bait. It was effective for only 2 years, because the Depression came along, so we only had Dirac and Fowler as visitors under that basis. Wenzel was also visiting professor for a term at Madison, but he essentially took my place when I was on my sabbatical in Europe in 1930.
Were the salaries more or less comparable?
Wisconsin and Minnesota?
Yes.
Yes, because Minnesota agreed to meet the Wisconsin offer after considerable hesitation and delay.
Well, they did hesitate.
Well, I mean, it took a look. They had to get the administrative approval and so on in echelons. I mean, the chairman was not in a position to say, I can meet that offer. But they asked me to.
Well, who were they?
I actually at one time declined the Wisconsin offer, and told Professor Erickson that I was staying, but I said, please keep that as confidential. I'm afraid he told Dean and other people about it, because I finally decided I wanted to go to Wisconsin. And in a period of just 3 or 4 days, something like that, I reversed myself and sent a telegram to Mendenhall saying I would come to Wisconsin.
Who were the members of the department when you came?
To Wisconsin?
To Wisconsin, yes.
Mendenhall was chairman. Max Mason had left. He was professor of mathematical physics. That's essentially the reason there was a vacancy at Wisconsin. There was Ingersoll, Roebuck, and Steve. He was mainly in the education branch.
Now, let's see, what rank were you when you came?
Professor.
You were full professor?
Yes. I'd got my full professorship a year before at the University of Minnesota.
How did...
Largely, perhaps as a result of an offer from Chicago.
How did your teaching responsibilities compare at Wisconsin with what you had at Minnesota?
A little lighter. I'd been giving 2 graduate courses at Minnesota, and I was only obliged to give 1 at Wisconsin, but I did usually give a 2nd one. So I would say there's not much difference in that.
But you did feel at home.
Yes.
There
was not much difference at that time in the caliber of the students at the two places. I had Bob Serber as perhaps my most distinguished PhD of the period I was in Madison from 28 to 34.
Now, your father was still on the faculty, was he not, at
one
the
year.
Time?
1 year. They overlapped 1 year.
You did. That must have been an interesting situation. I did read that he also taught Wesleyan with when his father was on the faculty. Is that correct?
That's correct. At least I presume it's correct. I don't really know the year that my grandfather became emeritus.
When did, before I go on to that, who are the people you remember most in Wisconsin that you were closest to?
During which period? During the period?
Well, let's go back to first, when you were a student.
As a student, I was not a fraternity man. I don't think I formed many lifetime friendships at that time. Harold Marx, who drove the car for my family, and I were good friends. I saw him recently when I was out in La Jolla last February. It was a great pleasure to see him again.
Well,
I played as a child with Larry Hall, who later became the cheerleader for the University of Wisconsin when he was in college. I guess he's now a lawyer in Madison. I would say that getting on to a little bit later stage of my life, I was a friend of Warren Weaver's during my junior and senior years at Wisconsin, but I looked up to him more or less as an older brother. He was much further along in his education towards a PhD than I was, but that's when our friendship started. I would say are my friends that I met in as Madisonians and as such, Warren Weaver was a person that was certainly closest to my own interests and so on.
Oh, I do understand that you were a member of the band when you were there. Is this correct?
That certainly is correct. And I say the peak of my musical career is when the stadium at Wisconsin was dedicated in 1917, and we beat Minnesota by a score of 10-7, a major upset. Minnesota had won 54-0 the year before. That was the peak of my musical career. I used to play the flute. I played in university orchestra, high school orchestra. I feel I got a great deal out of playing in the band. I think that meant as much to me as any one course at Wisconsin has proven to be in my later life. It got me familiar with music and so on.
Have you gone on with the flute? I mean, is it?
Well, I used to play it a while. I practically gave it up when I got married. I have less time then, so I'm afraid my career as a flutist, which was never a career,
ended
more or less in around 1930. I did play it two or three times out at George Harrison's house. He was a physicist at MIT after he moved to Cambridge in 34. But my playing the flute dropped out.
Was the
Paul Buck always remembers how I used to play the various college tunes on my flute in Conant Hall, the graduate dorm at Harvard where he and I both lived.
Was the band, I think possibly it might have been later, was that the band started making tours around the state?
Were it certainly that? Did. Because of the war, I never got to play with a band on the football team, a field other than the Wisconsin campus. But I do remember one tour we took in February 1917. Start off. Do you want some details on
that?
Oh,
I'd love them. Yes.
We gave our first concert in Baraboo. There were almost 50 in the band, and resources were such that they felt they couldn't even afford a standard sleeper. We had a tourist sleeper, and most students were housed two to a lower, but they ran out of space, so that freshmen had to be housed two and up in an upper berth.
Two and oh my.
And that's how I spent that week's tour. And it was so cold sometimes in our car that even the people that had a single upper berth, probably they were something in a very special echelon, a senior or something, were doubling up in order to get enough blankets and keep warm. That was one frigid tour.
Well,
gave a course a concert in Superior. We gave one in a little Indian town of Odana, I think I've got the name right, which is very near Ashland. And they had always won.
Okay.
I remember the manager of the band having to call the division superintendent of the Northwestern in Madison that we've got to get some heat. So finally they tied up a freight train, took the engine off of that, and that let us heat for the rest of the day. It was way below zero. And then there was a special train from Ashland out to this little Indian town of Adana for people that wanted to hear the concert. And our car was taken back to Ashland for the night, where there was a steam pipe connection. I remember the leader of Sogstad, the conductor of the band, saying he would never again take a trip, not in a standard sleeper, but I don't think that would have made too much difference in the heat. And he thought it was lucky that nobody got pneumonia on that trip. Nobody did. We also gave concerts in Warsaw, Oshkosh, and Fond du Lac. I even have a program of all the pieces we played in that tour. I sent a copy to Dvorak.
I'm sure he would have been very... Yes, it's spelled the same. It's confusing pronunciation. Well, I also gather that somewhere along there you developed your interest in football.
Yes. I don't know why. I was the worst person in the gym class and always was envious of people that had athletic ability. My attempts to try and play football as a kid were always pathetic, but I don't know how I developed that interest in football. I feel it, at least at present, football is so overdone that you really wonder whether it belongs in the framework of university education. But I always enjoyed going to football games.
Did any other sports interest you at all?
Baseball a little. I think I got interested mainly in sports where there was, a climax in the thing. like being on the 5-yard line or the bases loaded. It's something you don't have in soccer or hockey or basketball.
That's true. I never really thought of it like that. Here are these moments of high tension.
I never took too much interest in watching tennis because that always made me realize how bad I was as a tennis player, although that was a one athletic endeavor in which I was the most successful. There were two or three boys that had beaten tennis. I even won one set from Enrico Fermi in Michigan in the summer school of 33, but that was a set where he wasn't feeling this very well that day. I think that explained the reason.
Well, maybe.
He was a better player than I was.
I guess everyone has ups and downs at that. When, I understand that your family and the Ingram family were long time.
That is
friends.
True. Now, where my grandfather and I guess Mark's grandfather first met, I don't know. I think Mark can give you more details on the interrelation between the Ingram and Van Vleck family connections than I can give.
Well, he has talked to me a little bit about about this. And one early thing that I recall his mentioning was the two of you on some sort of tour in Italy. Was it Florence?
No, it was not a tour. We both happened to be in the town, with the our respective families, and Mark took me out to. On a little trip one afternoon, and I think that is mentioned in his introduction of me
in
the Van Vleck Hall brochure, so I don't think it's any point needing.
But he did, before I'd read that, he also mentioned it to me.
I don't know whether the record shows how Mark became a mathematician.
I'm not familiar with it, if it does. Do you?
Well, it was right after World War I, and suddenly students were flocking back to Wisconsin. And there was a question of finding another instructor. And there was somebody suggested by, I think, Princeton, but the recommendation, if you can call it such, said, poor teacher. And Father said, before I take a character like that, I'm going to gamble. And Mother came down to the breakfast table one day and she said, I've got an idea. I think Mark Ingram had a fair amount of work in mathematics as an undergraduate. And he wrote, I doubt if people even telephoned in those days, but he may have sent a wire to his sisters in Brooklyn who lived 3 or 4 houses from the Ingram house to find out more about Mark. And Father felt he had enough mathematics that he could make him an offer. Mark was, I think, then oil prospecting or doing something that he didn't care very much for. I'm not sure as to the precise thing he was doing at that time. At any rate, he accepted the position, and for some reason or other, he had to change cars, I thought it was in Pittsburgh, but more logically it would be Chicago. Anyway, he had some time to kill in a station, so he was frantically studying his calculus book to refresh him enough so he could start his lectures at Wisconsin. When he got to Madison, he found he reviewed not merely the first year, but the second year in addition to the course.
So he went on from there.
He went on from there, yeah. But I think, in a way, it was my mother that started him in this mathematical career.
Well, that is
a suggestion that mother came to him.
Well, I'd be interested. You've said and written how you got interested in physics. How did you, or what moved you in the particular branch of physics?
Quantum theory? Mm-hmm. Well, I found it interesting. As you know, quantum theory in the early 1920s was something that seemed to work very well for certain atomic phenomena, explain the frequency of the hydrogen lines, work qualitatively in the understanding of the spectra of other elements. It was enough truth in what's now called the old quantum theory that I was able to write my book that appeared in 1926. It was never called a book. It was a report of the National Research Council, but was effectively a book that was out of date by the time it came off the press, because quantum mechanics came along, but has proved to be very useful to historians of science some 40 or so years later. But I was interested in quantum theory, and Campbell gave me a problem to work on. It was a good problem. It was the same model of the helium atom that Niels Bohr suggested. Campbell did independently. America was not so far behind Europe as is sometimes represented in those days. And Cramers made the calculation for Bohr, and I made the calculation for Campbell. We both got the same result, which didn't agree with the experiment. That I've mentioned in two or three of my papers. I don't think I need to elaborate on that here.
Well, how did you get into the engineering and applied physics?
How did I become dean?
Yes, well, yes, and how did you get into the applied end of it?
Well, I was never particularly in the applied end, except that during the war, I did do some work on random noise and related problems. That was because I was at Radio Research Lab, which was dealing with radar countermeasures. The name was just camouflage, and I was head of the so-called theory group, a very small group.
This
that
is
work,
World War II,
I think,
right?
was somewhat applied in nature, because the papers writing up some of the work that I did there appeared in such journals as IEEE, was the Institute of Engineering and Electronics. I can't even remember what IEEE stands for. But that was just a brief interval in the war. It had nothing to do with my becoming Dean of Engineering and Applied Physics in 51.
How did that come about?
Well, I'd been departmental chairman of physics for 4 years right after the war. I'd been lucky because we'd gotten Purcell and Ramsey and Schwinger as addition to our staff, all men of great reputation. Ramsey is now is in charge of the big accelerator near Chicago. Besides his regular duties at Chicago, Swinger and Purcell have won Nobel Prizes. I was lucky in the choices that the department made at that time, but I must emphasize those were departmental choices, not my own. Harvard's a democratic institution, but although perhaps I provided some leadership in connection with one or two of the selections, I think perhaps I personally had something to do with. But then there was this McKay Endowment for the engineering area. And Harvard made some unsuccessful attempts to get a dean. They tried to get Jay Stratton from MIT, and they tried to get Ernie Lawrence from Berkeley. And then they decided, instead of having a dean, they would just have two appointment committees to decide what appointments were to be made in the engineering and applied physics area, largely because there were surplus funds from the Gordon McKay Endowment. And I'd been on innumerable committees, it seemed to me, where we haggled what we'd do in the way of building a science center for that area and things like that, who we would try to get here, and what areas to be developed. And I didn't feel that I supplied any great wisdom in any of those committee deliberations. But then Mr. Conant assembled the physics and I guess probably perhaps chemistry and engineering faculties together and explained they were going to have this new setup where they're going to have two appointment committees. And he read the names of those committees. I discovered that I was a member of both of them. One was, I guess, in electrical end, and one was more in the material science, metallurgy, mechanical engineering end. And I was walking out of the university hall where Jim comes up and says, "Van, I want you to be chairman of both committees." He hadn't announced that to me, meaning I was completely flabbergasted. Well, I got into this question of appointments and involved in the area, and finally they asked me if I would be dean. Well, I was a very close friend of Paul Buck, who was then provost at Harvard, very influential in the Harvard administration, also a friend of Conant, and finally decided that I would accept the invitation. It was not something that I went out for and was a candidate for, quite the contrary.
Something imposed. Did you enjoy that?
Yes and no. It was a challenge. As such, it was interesting. It acquainted me with different fields of applied science than I'd known about otherwise. I enjoyed meeting some of the people on our visiting committee, although some of them felt that I was a completely inappropriate appointment to that position because I was not a real engineer. That created some difficulties and problems for me, diverted problems, time from my research work. I probably would have gotten that second edition of my book completed rather than still be working on it now. I respected and enjoyed meeting the good engineers. There were some who were less able to
Who did you
had a rather, I think, a rather old-fashioned concepts of engineering. The pattern that Harvard adopted, I would say, is more or less the one that Yale subsequently did.
Who did you consider the good engineers?
Which branch of engineering you're considering?
Well, either. The ones you...
Well, civil engineering, we did not try to compete with MIT, and we didn't have the... material resources for that. In applied mathematics, I think Carrier, whom we got from Brown, is a very good person in the field, which almost fringes in on elasticity. Soil mechanics, Harvard had something of a tradition between Terzaghi and the Casagrande brothers, who were already on the staff when I took over in the area.
It occurs to me... Go ahead.
Well, Bell Lab has had some very fine men in electrical engineering, any of which would have been very nice to have had at Harvard.
What I started to say was that I'm supposing you probably knew Sumner Schlichter.
Oh, I knew Sumner very well. I had great fondness and respect for Sumner.
Now, since his father was at Wisconsin, your two families been close at all?
Not especially, I should say. I mean, they were friendly, but I would not say that they were as closely knit as the Van Blecks and Skinner families. But I have become the next generation. I became a longtime friend of Sumner Schlichter, a friend of Louis Schlichter's. He was at MIT during a period when I was at Harvard. He was also in Cambridge for a year when I was a graduate student or instructor, I forget which. And I've had Charlie Schlichter as a class student of mine and as my advisee. And as you know, besides being professor at University of Illinois, he is now a member of the Harvard Corporation. He and Bloom of Yale were the first two faculty people to be made members of the Harvard Corporation, which is the inner sanctuary of the governing boards. It's the large group is called the Board of Overseers, but there is a smaller group called the President and Fellows of Harvard College, which has only about five or so members, and Charlie is one of them. I think very highly of him.
Who else? Going back to there are several people that are, I guess, emeritus now at Wisconsin, and you might have known fairly well. Is Rolfson one of them?
Yes, Rolfson is a graduate student when I was at Wisconsin during the period from 28 to 34. I was the one that suggested the problem that he'd take for his PhD thesis, namely investigating the dispersion of HCl. I didn't like the existing measurements. That was an experimental thesis done with methanol, but that, I think, has been a field which is perhaps been his major research field over the years.
How about Donald Kurst?
Donald Kurst was not a PhD student of mine. He was an able student, took courses with me, and gave my course in mechanics during the winter term that I taught at Stanford in 33-34.
I see.
Serber gave the course in quantum mechanics in my place.
You mentioned something about Max Mason a little while ago. Did you know him well?
Not well. I was never far enough along to take courses from him. He was very violently against quantum theory. That is pointed out by Warren Weaver in his book. And, of course, subsequent developments have shown that quantum theory was what led to quantum mechanics, which is, well, I say, revolutionized the understanding of chemistry and physics, because it enables us for the first time to understand what's going on inside the atom and what is the mathematical structure of all of chemistry. As Dirac says in one of his papers, something I quote, that the mathematical theory necessary for the understanding of now of a large part of physics and all of chemistry is now virtually complete.
That's an interesting statement. Do you think it is possible for it to be completely complete?
Well, what goes on inside the nucleus we still don't know. In these very, very high energy particles, high energy physics, that is a different matter. That we still don't know. There are more and more of these elementary particles and so on. But if you want the mathematical framework, which in principle enables us to calculate the frequency of any spectral line or what holds a solid together, any of the, what I would call, the physics of ordinary matter, we have the mathematical framework. The complications of having billions and billions of atoms all bound together in a solid state are such you can never perhaps solve the problem exactly, but in principle we can. And so in principle we have the framework which enables us to calculate any chemical reaction whatsoever.
What I've been interested in the what effect the development of the computer has had on progress of mathematical theory and
Well, I feel that the computerized mathematical physics belongs to a different era than my own. That to show how far along computers were in my day, Professor Huntington told me that in connection with my calculating these orbits that I needed for my doctor's thesis in the old quantum theory, it'd be nice if I could have the use of a Monroe computing machine, which belonged to the economics department, was in Massachusetts Hall. And it was a hand-cranked affair. It's not nearly as good an apparatus as something that I bought recently for $50 in response to an ad in the Sunday New York Times. That was computers in my day, and I never really learned anything about the programming and featuring of what can be done with computers, other than to have a respect for great accomplishments that computers can produce, but also the belief, in fact, it's not a belief, it's a truth, that computers are no brighter than the people that operate them. If you have people that make mistakes in computers, there'll still be an erroneous result. That is sometimes, I think, not particularly realized. Have mistakes nowadays with bills and so on, and they say it's all the fault of the computer. Of course, it's the fault of who operated the computer and how it's operated.
Yes, I'd go along with that, I guess. Not much difficulty. Now, one of your... I haven't said anything about your receiving the Nobel Prize so far, but I did read that one of the people who shared it with you had been a student of yours.
That's right, Bill Anderson.
This, I'm guessing, was at Harvard.
Yes, he wrote his PhD thesis under me at Harvard on a topic which was not the topic for which he received his Nobel Prize. That was his doctor's thesis was on the theory of line widths, spectral lines, and his work for the Nobel Prize was largely concerned with magnetism.
Which was also what yours was, is
that
correct?
That's right.
Well, I heard you say that you did this work a long, long time ago.
Yes, some of the best work I did was while I was in Madison. I'd already published while I was at Minnesota some basic problems on the general structure of the formulas for magnetism and quantum mechanics. But while in Madison, I finished my book on electric and magnetic susceptibilities, and I had two very able postdocs from Europe. One of them was Robert Slapp from Edinburgh, and the other was Bill Penny, now Lord Penny. I wonder how many other badgers they have in the House of Lords.
It would be interesting to know.
He already had his PhD, but he thought he would like to have a Wisconsin degree, so he has a Wisconsin MA, besides having a PhD.
Oh, that is not too,
I always hoped
not too
that
usual.
Wisconsin would give him an honorary degree, but that has not materialized.
They haven't.
It would be nice to have a citation referring to the fact that one day opened the Daily Cardinal and discovered that Wisconsin had beaten Michigan in hockey in soccer by 5-2 or something like that. And of the 5 Wisconsin goals, 4 were kicked by Penny. Well, I said to Bill the next day, "Is that any chance you?" He said, "Yes. Once in a while, I go off and play with the boys." You see, soccer in those days was not a highly policed intercollegiate contest. And when Bill would play with the team, we beat everybody. I had a lot of fun referring to that when I gave a lecture for the Royal Society a few years ago with Bill in the audience.
Oh, yes. I guess not too many people would have known about that.
I don't know. And, Bill playing with the Wisconsin team is a little like the people, some of the people that played with the Boilermakers, that's Purdue, when they played Wisconsin. Most people think Purdue got that name because it was an engineering school. Instead, the Monon Shops were there, and whenever they needed a good left tackle before the Wisconsin game, they would manage to borrow somebody from the Monon Shops. And
well,
that's
how why
the
they're called
Boilermakers got its name. Right. That's well authenticated, mentioned by my friend Ed Purcell, who was a Purdue graduate, besides being a Nobel laureate.
I'm going to have to... Do you suppose that you might talk about or make some comparisons between the department as you first became acquainted with it at Wisconsin and as you knew it later on when you were on the faculty?
Well, I was not thinking so much of the department as about Wisconsin's
the
university and
university.
The whole, atmosphere of the university. Of course, specifically as regards the department, why it's enormously bigger now than it was then. I don't know if it had grown too much between when I was an undergraduate in 1928, but after the war, physics became a well-known profession, and as you know, the buildings devoted to it has acquired the old chemistry building and expanded. It's a much bigger operation than it was then. When I was there, there was just one departmental secretary, Molly McGuire. She was supposed to do all the secretarial work for everybody. So as a result, we didn't have as much secretarial help as even the most fledgling assistant professor expects nowadays. The campus at university, I think, was much more Joe College in 1916-20 than it was in 1928-34. There were differences noticeable just in that time. And there was a rush, which I think was a disgrace, which was held between the freshmen and sophomores.
This a bag rush?
Yes, bag rush.
I have heard something about it.
Well, I think that the university was more dominated by fraternities and sororities. I'm not a fraternity man in the 16-20 era than it was in the 28-34. The prom was held at the state capitol with great fanfare right after the war, whereas it was held in the great hall of the Union in the 1930s, and faculty members were invited to attend as guests. I remember we went to that, but it was, a less ostentatious affair than in the proms of their early days. I think the whole university seemed rather less Joe College than in the early days, with possible exception of summer school, which is not a matter, and in a different way. But I feel that Wisconsin and Minnesota had high standards for their advanced work in physics in those days. You get sometimes the impression that all of science, advanced physics of any caliber, was confined to the two coasts, and that was, I think, is not warranted if you look at the facts.
Now that interests me.
I might mention that at Minnesota, there was one student we felt was substandard, that was not reappointed as a teaching fellow, which amounted from more or less for us not wanting him as a PhD. And a few years later, I would discover that he was just finishing his PhD at Berkeley. I have a little Wisconsin, Minnesota chauvinism in this. And another interesting thing I think is rather amusing. Pinpoint the exact year. I think it's probably the fall of 33 that the Daily Cardinal, which had fallen into the hands of, what will I say, a rather liberal, intellectually minded group of editors, came out with an editorial panning President Frank for attending and speaking at a mass meeting preceding the Chicago game.
Oh, why did they object?
Well, they felt they had some quotation from, I don't know, some, I don't know, Thomas More or some buddy, somebody in English saying playing with a ball does not improve the mind or something like that. I'm afraid they were probably a thorn in the, as regards the athletic department. Well, that same year, I was invited to be a visiting lecturer at Stanford for the winter term. And when I arrived there, I discovered that all university classes had been called off for one particular hour so that the football insignia could be awarded by Pop Warner, and the president was there attending. I thought that was a rather interesting comparison between the Wisconsin and Stanford in those days. Stanford was certainly much more Joe College in those days. They shot off a gun whenever a man walked in and accepted his a bid to join a particular fraternity. We were staying in a house and wondered whether there was a civil war going on or what. It was just the new pledges appointing, reporting for their fraternities. Now the whole atmosphere at Stanford is completely different. It has this large cluster of electronic firms around it, due in part to influence of Professor Terman, Hewlett and Packard and so on. It has this great complex around it. So I think Stanford has changed from being a, what I say, largely a liberal arts school, but with a distinguished faculty, to one that is, has a very strong ingredient in the area of engineering and applied physics. The belt around Stanford, you might say, is like our present Route 128 around Boston. And it was not like that at all in 1928 to 34. Last night I heard on the TV verifying program The World of Victor Herbert, and it stressed the fact that 50 years ago the whole atmosphere was so different from what it was now, less cynical, more sentimental, more simple. It almost brought tears into my eyes. That was the era that I grew up in. We're still essentially that type of Wisconsin in 1928 to 1934. Those were the good old days. The co-eds went up the hill on a zero day in silk stockings without anything covering their ears. They wanted to look good. Now they go around in dungarees. Seems aren't just what they used to be.
They certainly are not. You are, it just occurred to me that you were there during the period of time when Glenn Frank was president, and also when the Experimental College was in existence. Did you hear anything about that? I don't suppose you had any direct connection with it.
I don't think my father was ever an enthusiast for the Experimental College. He said it was just reversion to the curricula of the 19th century, the British institutions. I think it's almost too much of a shock to take a boy from a farm background in northern Wisconsin and expect him to spend the first year studying Greek civilization and nothing else. And it was much more successful, of course, with a group of rather radically minded students from the New York area had always responded enthusiastically that they were being experimented on with something that is definitely liberal and new. I remember we had there was a symposium on the experimental college at the faculty club, I guess it's called the university club, one evening, and the argument people for the experimental college made their arguments in its favor, and it finally was a little more than I could stand, and I said, what's so wrong with the present system where a student can shop around and see what courses he likes and have the fluidity that's implied by that rather than this other kind of rigid curriculum? And I thought maybe I'd made a fool of myself, but I heard another couple of faculty members saying to the other when he walked out of when they walked out, the only person that said anything sensible in that meeting was Van Vleck. So at least two people agreed with me. I'm afraid I was not enthusiastic with experimental college.
Well, you had a lot of company, I'd rather gather in that respect.
On the other hand, there's some of my friends like Mally Sharp felt it was a very worthwhile enterprise. But the story I've heard, I presume it's true, that Dean Slichter came back just frothing at the mouth after a luncheon, and secretaries were trying to figure out what was wrong. You're saying it wasn't even clean, it isn't even sanitary, to say nothing of the manners. Been at this lunch in the experimental college where they're throwing mashed potato at each other or something of the kind. I've heard that story. I think it's true, but I would not sign an affidavit.
But it's an interesting thought.
I think it's probably true.
They probably were feeling a little bit full of themselves. Have you, you were talking about the university and when you were on the faculty, have you had occasion to go back since?
Oh, yes, I've given colloquia and so on. I've been back on an average once every 3 years since 1934, more often, in fact, every year until Mother died in 1948. And then the visits, of course, became less frequent.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's been pleasant, though.
How do you feel about the university now? Of course, it's a great deal larger, I feel, than it.
I feel it's a great university. I feel it would have felt happier if it was just the University of Wisconsin, period, rather than University of Wisconsin at Madison. That would be the way I'd feel on that one.
You're not all out enthusiastic for this merger.
That's right, although I'm really not in a position to speak with any authority. I mean, with any great background or study.
Well, which reminds me, speaking of merger, I know you knew Warren Weaver. How well acquainted were you with John Weaver?
Not at all. He's a different generation. He's Andrew and Cornelia Weaver's son. That's all I know.
So you didn't have any occasion to get to know him?
No. Pleasant relationship. I looked up to him for guidance. I think if it had not been for him, I might have stayed on as an instructor at Harvard, which would have been a great mistake, rather than taking this fine offer from Minnesota.
Well, he encouraged you to go to Minnesota.
Yes. I don't think I've got now the first page of the description of my life, which will appear in the Nobel Prize volume. I'll send you a copy of that if you'd like.
Oh yes, I would like it very much. Well, I think now.